This is Christopher Hawk, May 9th, 2003, Jung Film.
What's that all about? It was just for us, wasn't it, us tourists? They don't have to do it, do they? It's not an old Native American thing, I'm sure. It might have been. Anyway, a lot of American films I'm going to show you tonight. In fact, at least two of them start with the word American. American Graffiti, American Beauty. Truman Show, Pleasantville. Tonight, Sharon was saying it's like yesterday was a precursor of today. Well, today is definitely a precursor of tomorrow. I have flyers for tomorrow as well, and I would encourage you to perhaps try, if you possibly can, spare the time, come to tomorrow as well as this evening. This evening I designed, and it's called Anima and Individuation in Movies, for people who know a little bit about Jung, a little bit about what anima and animus is and what individuation is. But tomorrow I sort of do the historical thing. I go back to basics and talk about the beginnings of movies and psychoanalysis, you know, in the 1890s with Lumiere and, of course, Freud. Thank you very much. Lumiere in Paris and Freud in Vienna. And we take it through what is the exact difference and the special take that Jungians have on movies that contrasts with the Freudian way of understanding movies and then the Lacanian way of understanding movies. So we'll talk a tiny bit about that tonight. But mainly this will be a sort of example of applying some Jungian ideas to certain films rather than actually telling you how we do it and, you know, making a case for it. That'll be what we'll work on tomorrow, which will be a slightly longer day, I believe, right through to 2 o'clock. So I hope you'll be able to come to that too. So today it's anima and individuation in movies. And I want to look at two themes that Jungian film writing has brought to light. The anima and the use of gender oppositions and conjunctions in movies. And I wish to show how both these link closely with this Jungian concept of individuation, which is the path towards fulfilling one's potential as a human being, and why this theme is so pertinent to the contemporary society and the psyche of men and women in our postmodern era. Now, key to Jungian psychology is the way that the unconscious is conceived as having a compensatory function. Whether through dreams, fantasies, behaviors, or more pathological symptoms, the unconscious tends to act against the one-sidedness of the conscious mind in a compensatory fashion. The disjunction between the conscious and unconscious mind has been grasped through the complementary images of Apollonian and Dionysian attitudes. And too much Apollo in any era or individual, and Dionysus will come in through the back door. And it's for this reason we need to be aware of our unconscious other, and over time, integrate it into consciousness. Now, the idea of the unconscious having a compensatory function is linked with the Jungian view of psyche as consisting of oppositional elements. All this should be familiar to you, but I'll go over it again. Although we may be skeptical about Jung's biological emphasis when he says all of nature consists of oppositions, there's little doubt that human mental activity across the majority of cultures and eras displays a tendency to grasp and define reality in oppositional terms. And many of these oppositions, such as light and dark, night and day, sun and moon, seem self-evident. And yet, on closer examination, constructing these pairs of opposites is very much a human meaning-making activity of our psyches and not necessarily inherent in the phenomena themselves at all. Ancient Taoist philosophy describes the completeness of existence according to the complementary pairing of yin and yang. And these opposing principles are then analogized along the lines of opposites such as light and dark, hill and valley, but they're most commonly analogized as male and female. Throughout the ages, human beings have used gender difference to construct their world and to make psychological and emotional sense of it. As the Jungian analyst Beverly Zabriskie puts it, she says, the receptive and the penetrating, the near and the distant, the cyclic and the linear, the containing and the moving were manifest pairs, complements, opposites in both the elements and creatures of nature. They were assigned gender, the most apparent carrier of difference. Gender was thus projected onto and seen in correspondence with humankind's external surroundings. However, oppositional thinking in contemporary times tends towards a hierarchy that makes one pole more valued than the other. The less valued pole then becomes merely an other to serve the positive definition of its more valued opposite. In this way, in our Judeo-Christian era, light has become superior to dark, consciousness more valued than the unconscious, and under patriarchy, the male is deemed superior to the female. And Jung noted that the dominant conscious values that had informed Western men and women over the last 2,000 years were masculine in nature. Zabriskie says, authority and dominance within hierarchical structures, penetrating and focused assertion and aggression, superiority of linear cognition, and a detached rationality. This is what it is to be a human and have a human psyche in this particular post-Enlightenment era. And within a way of thinking about the psyche that regarded it in tension and balance between pairs of opposites, then the unconscious became characterized as feminine. As Zabriskie says of Jung, she says, insofar as he believed the unconscious to have a compensatory function in relation to the cultural dominance and the established ego, it followed that the intuitive, elliptical, contextual, and emotionally charged mythopoeic language and imagery of the unconscious shared qualities and associations with those outside the prevailing order. The poets, mystics, dreamers, lunatics, lovers, and women. Jung's personal experience was key to this understanding of the psyche of contemporary men. It was a female voice that he encountered in his own imaginal self-analysis, and this is what he said. I'll spare you the Swiss accent. Or maybe I won't. I was greatly intrigued by the fact that a woman should interfere, that's the word he uses, interfere with me from within, he says. My conclusion was she must be the soul in the primitive sense, and I began to speculate on the reasons why the name anima was given to the soul. Why was it thought of as feminine? Later, I came to see that this inner feminine figure plays a typical or archetypal role in the unconscious of a man, and I called her the anima. The corresponding figure in the unconscious of a woman I called the animus. It's she who communicates the images of the unconscious to the conscious mind, and that is what I chiefly valued her for. I'll read that bit again. It's she who communicates the images of the unconscious to the conscious mind, and that is what I chiefly valued her for. In other words, anima and animus are not simply the genderized other in the psyches of men and women, respectively. Their appearance, anima and animus, their appearance in dreams and other narratives, such as the movies I'm going to introduce, signals an encounter with the other, our unconscious selves. Through the struggles which ensue, such encounters can lead to knowing ourselves more fully, and the greater discovery of our collective human being. And this is the path of individuation. Now, when it comes to viewing movies with a Jungian attitude or perspective, the text of the movie, a term that refers to the totality of the film's imagery, narrative, editing, camera work, and sound, the whole thing is allowed to work on the psyche so that the individual viewer makes the film somehow their own. A sort of, not quite a participation mystique, but certainly, if the film's projected out there, you're projecting yourself into the film as well, so there's definitely two-way projection going on. And this works collectively too, in that large numbers of filmgoers make movies relevant to themselves collectively, sometimes according to the times. The film American Graffiti, which we'll see a clip of in a second, was, for example, one of the first of a wave of nostalgia movies, though it was only set 10 years earlier than it was made. It was made in 72 and it's set in about 1962. And this led urban US and European audiences to reflect somehow on more innocent times. It was a wave of this nostalgia business, pre-Vietnam, pre-computers, pre-oil crisis even in 72. And to somehow reflect again on their own humanity, their values and aims, which had become blurred through the 60s and the early 70s. And because films engage with the collective psyche, they both convey and bring forth archetypes. And in a way, American Graffiti certainly engaged with the archetype of youth, and it certainly engaged with the archetype of Rite de Passage and the moving from youth to maturity. The archetype of youth, as you know, is this puer eternus, the eternal boy, and it's always paired with something called the senex, or the wise old man, and there is always a sort of going together of this young eternal boy and wise old man. They're like anima and animus, they're complements, they're opposites, but they're hardly ever distant from each other. And I think you might reflect that in this film, do you remember the disc jockey whose voice is going all the way through it and who Dreyfuss has to go and find, Wolfman Jack? He somehow represents another generation who is just totally connected, like Senex is to Pua, with the generation who are actually starting to move out of youth into maturity in their different ways. And because these opposites of Senex and Pua are often paired, just as Animus and Anima are paired, because they represent some sort of completeness, but one which we most often experience only in a one-sided fashion. Wolfman Jack, the guy you hear on the radio in this first clip, he's of an older generation, but it's he whose persona and radio show inspire the young characters throughout the film. And what happens here is you'll see, I don't know if you remember this, because it's a very sort of small, undeveloped theme of the film, and I think it's something that probably happened accidentally and probably wasn't in the original script. But you know, they're cruising around and Dreyfuss is in the back of the car, and Dreyfuss turns around and looks through the window and sees this girl, a blonde girl in a white T-bird, and she says something to him through the window, and he wants them to chase her and find her. And his path through the film, although he engages with all sorts of scenes with all sorts of other people, in the end leads him getting to Wolfman Jack and putting out a message on the radio for this mysterious girl to ring him on the phone, and he sleeps the night outside the phone booth and then speaks to her at the end. And I want you to listen to some of the words he uses about this girl and tell me what your reflections are on that. The clip I've got is when he first encounters her, just through the windows of the cars when they're cruising around. And then I've cut it right through to where he's waiting by the phone for the phone call and then his final phone call to her at the end. So this is American Graffiti. Now this is where we need some lights going off. Right. Oh, sorry, can I just have a light on till I switch it on? Right, let's go. What's he doing? Okay, it doesn't matter. Okay, that's led him through this Rite de Passage night that leads on to, of course, him going off to college, and I think he becomes a writer. And you know that very final scene where the credits are rolling? You know, one of them gets killed in Vietnam, one of the boys... Paul Lamar gets killed in a road crash. Of course, Dreyfuss goes off to college, as it says, and the plane's taken off, and he looks out the window, and the last thing he sees is that white T-bird on the road, just following the plane. So that is a final echo. He's both left it behind, but it's still with him, because this is an inner image. This is an inner image. Anything else you thought about that? Yeah. He's got his whole lifetime to find out now. Yeah, this thing, yeah. Which is part of himself. And introduces himself to the rest of himself. Yes, he's consumed. He's possessed.
That is the anima.
That's what you've seen. Yes. But he's not distracted by any real girlfriend either, though, you see. He can have these fantasies. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's very significant. Any dreams when you're in the back seat and you move to the front seat, or... Yeah, very significant. Yeah. So, you know, these other young guys, their individuation gets curtailed while we see that Kurt, Dreyfuss, has the chance to mature. And I think this depiction of individuation, although it's a sort of Rite de Passage version of it, and a very obvious one here, it's been a theme common to American films of the late 20th century, very common indeed. And I think some of these scenes show how the most powerful movies are created as art forms through which archetypes emerge. That's why you can't really repeat it. You can't do American Graffiti 2 and make it work, because you can't use this as a formula. I think these are spontaneous expressions that are coming through. And just like we know novelists tell us that suddenly the characters start speaking for themselves, and suddenly the characters start telling the writer which way the story goes and what they say to each other. I think this happens on movies, that people get ideas collectively and other scenes develop, and filmmakers have told me about this. And so I don't think we should be so cynical about it being such a manufactured process. Partly it is, you know, with the studios in control and budgets and things like that. But I think true inspiration happens, and human spirit and psyche does express itself through movies, and I hope I get that across tonight somehow. Now, just a word about Freudian approaches to films. Freudian approaches, and I could say quite a bit more about this tomorrow, about signs and symbols, but Freudian approaches have tended to interpret movies in a more rationalizing way, similar to the way in which dreams, under the Freudian way of approaching them, are regarded as having a manifest meaning, a surface meaning, behind which a latent or true meaning must be discovered, a sort of surface and hidden depths type of idea. In the Freudian way of looking at things, narratives and character dynamics and the imagery of movies get reduced to meanings along the lines of Freudian theories, such as the Oedipus complex, theories about superego and repression of the sexual instinct. Now, Jung differentiated this signs or semiotic approach from his preferred symbolic attitude to images and representations. And the difference is, just briefly, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow if you come, and I'll show you some examples. The difference is, whereas a sign always stands for something that's known, a symbol for Jung and the Jungian way of thinking about things, a symbol is always the expression or a representation of something unknown, which can't be expressed at that time in any final or any better way than the symbol is expressing it. So it doesn't stand for something we can translate into something else. That's a sign. A symbol is something that stands for something unknown that we can't express in any better way at the moment. Now, Jungian approaches may interpret as well, of course, as I've done with American Graffiti in a way. You know, I've said she is anima, and that's what he's experiencing. But in pointing out notional archetypes like the anima, there's no final meaning or interpretation implied. Nothing final. It's more technique for indicating further depths to movies, which is similar to the Freudian approach, you know, trying to find further depths and more meaning, but different in the way that it stays with the imagery offered by the film and lets it work on the psyche non-rationally and clearly, or rather cloudily, in the realm of the imagination. It's in the imagination where the movie begins and ends, and there it does its work as long as we allow ourselves to engage at a feeling level so that psyche may release its own amplified train of fantasies. So when we engage with these images, just like we've seen there, other things have come up for you. And it's important, just like you're considering your own dreams, or like a therapist considers someone else's dreams, that the other images that come up and are generated by this stuff, and you allow to resonate with yourself, that's what does the work, what comes up for you. It's not a new interpretation we need for movies, but a new attitude to our engagement with these images. Now, there's a very well-known San Francisco Jungian analyst, and next Sunday week, I'll be talking about some of these issues with him around another rather old film called L'Atalante by a filmmaker who died very young in France called, I think it was Jean Vigo. We'll be talking about that film. I'm sure we'll be talking about anima. But I want to let you know some of the things that John Beebe has said about anima, and I'll show you a clip from American Beauty, which I think illustrates several of them. He's well known, Beebe, for his analysis of movies, and especially anima and animus as they appear in films. And in his chapter in the book, Jung and Film, he lists several functions and representations of the anima as she appears in movies. And many of these elements, I think, are evident in this clip from American Beauty and the rest of American Beauty, where a middle-aged man, as you know, Kevin Spacey, becomes inspired both through fantasy and real-life encounters with a rather young teenager, Angela Hayes, to restore and relive aspects of himself which he's abandoned over the years. So in a way, it's like a middle-aged rite de passage. Sad, but essential for some. And the girl is a friend of the man's daughter, and this young girl, Angela Hayes, fulfills several of Phoebe's list of anima functions. One of the things he says, the anima figure, she wants to be loved, or occasionally to be hated, in either case, living for connection, as is consistent with her general role as representative of the status of the man's unconscious eros, and particularly representative of his relationship with himself. And I think that's a key thing to understanding Angela Hayes in American Beauty. He also talks about the way in which the anima character has some unusual capacity for life, in vivid contrast to the other characters in the film. So if you think about Angela Hayes in comparison with the mother in the film, who is sort of strangulated by her job as a realtor, an estate agent, as we call it, and the daughter, who's very tangled up with her identity and who she is as a teenager, they've got very constricted ways of being compared to Angela Hayes, who feels full of energy and full of life, just in comparison to them. And of course, the wife of the man next door, the soldier's wife next door, the ex-army guy, she's almost catatonic in her absence of life, I think. And again, in relation to her friend and the friend's father, Spacey, this girl, Angela Hayes, fulfills the functions, that Phoebe says, of offering a piece of advice frequently couched in the form of an almost unacceptable rebuke, which has the effect of changing another character's relation to a personal reality. And I reckon there's something in that about what she says about his body and these funny comments, sort of inappropriate really, she says to the daughter of the Kevin Spacey character, her friend, about her father, which starts to change everything, and it leads everyone through the film. Her relationship with Spacey makes everything change in the film. The man, his wife and daughter all address their personal realities out of their encounter with the girl. Well, the daughter of Spacey seems to be the one who benefits from the therapeutic effect in her struggles with the masculine, as she finds it in her father by more successfully getting it together with the new boyfriend. And finally, he says, less positively, the anima character leads another character, and again, I would suggest this: she leads the father-daughter pair in American Beauty, to recognize a problem in personality that's insoluble. Indirectly, she also influences that military bully father next door through the way in which her effect on Spacey leads to this character revealing his homosexuality to Spacey, and with disastrous results. And lastly, of course, Spacey's individuation. Sorry if you haven't seen the film, but lastly, he says this at the beginning, and it's not spoiling anything. His individuation ends in death anyway, he dies. So it's interesting how Phoebe notes that the loss of the anima character, because, you know, when Spacey realizes she's a virgin and she's young, he comes to his senses and he doesn't make love with her. The loss of the anima character is associated with the loss of purposeful aliveness itself. So, you know, whether the writers and the directors and the actors in this film knew that this was a way of thinking about this aspect of themselves or not, they certainly brought something together that's very similar to these elements. And Beebe doesn't mention American Beauty at all. I think he perhaps wrote it before American Beauty came out. So let's just see this clip. This is the first encounter with the girl, really. Okay, lights out. Yeah, just in case you thought it was all reality, yeah. Is it Menges? He puts that fantasy scene in, which is fantastic. Fantastic. Anything else you wanted to say about that? Don't know who you're all identified with. Everyone, I think, from moment to moment. Right. Now, following my remarks at the beginning, you know, about compensatory function, oppositions, and anima and animus being more to do with something connecting up in ourselves, I want to expand the oppositional aspect of anima animus to show how it carries implications for our over-rationalizing consciousness. and the way in which its other, the unconscious psyche, is dangerously ignored in our times. The idea of the unconscious and the feminine coinciding and becoming linked due to their shared position as being other to cultural dominance, which are a masculinist, patriarchal mode of being, I think is central to this post-Jungian view of analytical psychology as a radical response to modernity. So, you know, as much as it's a useful method and perspective when treating people in distress, it's also a whole attitude to the type of culture we've created for ourselves out of the type of consciousness we've developed since Enlightenment times. So it helps us think about ourselves even when we're not neurotic or in pathological states. The movies I discuss from now on are all narratives of individuation involving men and women who move from an initial awareness of lack or incompleteness towards a more developed, more fully human sense of their own human being by the movie's end. It shouldn't surprise us then that cultural products that seek to address imbalance in the contemporary psyche and culture will tend to do so along the lines of gender difference. In these movies, the characters' search for a fuller sense of themselves is often played out along the lines of masculine and feminine values. As we've just seen, in some movies, the anima character directly influences a singular male hero. But in other films, both men and women benefit equally from a breakthrough into fuller awareness that the critical questioning of the dominant conscious values brings. And here I'm thinking of two quite light films, but quite serious in another way, Pleasantville and The Truman Show, which I discuss shortly. The Loss of Eden, another male-female problem there, or rather a realization of its inadequacy for living a fuller human life, are the concerns of these three films. And although the third one I discuss, Dark City, which I'll tell you about in a minute, that begins in a false hell, while the other two begin in a false Eden, the movement in the narrative is comparable between all three of them. Because what all three have in common is the way they depict worlds that are seamless, by which I mean there are no disjunctions or complexities for the inhabitants of the world of these three films. The general populations in Dark City and in Pleasantville all seem to accept without question the conditions of their existence in the particular circumstances in which we find them. In the town in The Truman Show, everyone also appears to accept their conditions. In each case, but in different ways, we in the audience are in a privileged position of knowing something that none of them, the others, don't know. In The Truman Show, we rapidly get the idea that Truman's world is a TV show, and everyone in it knows this except him. In this case, we're sharing the same knowledge of the true state of the world with everyone but the hero. And out of this awareness arises a dramatic tension between that which we share with all the population, knowledge we share, and the knowledge of which Truman knows nothing. His grail search, his path of individuation, lies in his journey towards the truth of his existence, which we are forced to follow. And strangely enough, in this I'm reminded of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, and a hugely ironic moment for the audience when Oedipus, the king of Thebes, says, "I must unravel the secret of my birth." And his wife, Jocasta, who is at this stage of the drama clearly halfway to glimpsing the truth that the audience already knows, she replies, "These things must be kept hidden if life is to be endured." Oedipus sees the truth of his birth and his subsequent actions, and he promptly blinds himself. Full knowledge of his reality, release from his metaphorical blindness, means he has to live the rest of his life suffering actual blindness. And in a parallel way, Truman's discovery of the truth of his birth — he was born into this TV show and the audience have known him since he was a baby — ends in his suffering. But like Oedipus, it's preferable to suffer in the fullness of knowledge of his condition than to continue in darkness and ignorance. Now, this first clip is when, again, a female character starts revealing to Truman that things are not what they seem, meaning that she blurts out to him that it's all an act. And then something goes wrong with the technology of his world, and he gets a second clue. I need to put this in, so could you leave the light on for a second? Thanks. Okay, let's see if we've got it now. Are you familiar with that film? It's great, you must see it. You must see it. I mean, that last bit you saw there, for those who you don't know, I mean, everything is being run. It's a whole TV soap he is part of, and he's the only person who is not an actor. He's the only person who doesn't know what's going on. And the whole show is about him, ever since he's been a baby. He was born into it. It's quite tragic. It's a bit like real life. That's how it goes. What can I say about this? Well, I'll say a bit more about it, because you see the end of all three of these films, because that's where the tragic happens, when you see the end. Two of the ends are poor endings, meaning negative, and meaning the individuation leads to something uncreative, and one ending is okay. But Pleasantville, the other clip I want to show you, is similar to Truman Show, in that the town here, the town of the film Pleasantville, is again a TV soap, but it's set in the 1950s, and it's made very clearly other to our own world, because it's all filmed in black and white up to a certain point. And in this film, two teenagers from our own world, our side, who we identify with, as they get trapped in the world of this TV soap through some sort of magic. They get trapped on the other side of the screen of this old TV soap in black and white, the world of Pleasantville. And slowly but surely, they transform the town into a more realistic, more complex and beautiful, and of course, more problematic world, a lot like their own and like ours is. And this transformation is signaled through the gradual appearance of colour in Pleasantville. The first instance, which we see in this clip, being a rose that glows red after one innocent high school lad is introduced to sexual pleasure by the girl from our side. It's a brother and sister pair who go through, and it's the girl who deals with all the changes, or the boy wants everything to stay the same. He's a bit of a boffin on this TV soap. He knows all about it, and everything's got to stay the same. But the girl doesn't care for that, and she institutes every change that happens. Other elements of reality creep in, such as the reality that the basketball team can lose instead of winning all the time, the way in which rain falls for the first time ever in this show. But together with these apparently less desirable changes, positive effects occur. One character begins to enjoy and express himself through vivid paintings and allows himself to love someone else who's unhappily married, while all the kids discover that the books in the library, and this is a great scene, all these books, they've previously been totally empty blank pages in them. And as they start taking an interest in them, each page fills up with text, you know, like Tom Sawyer and all these greats of American literature, and they're filling up with words and filling up with richness of life, like, as the pages of the book stop being blank. In our privileged position, though, as the cinema audience, we know what the population of Pleasantville does not know about their world. Its false idealism and its absence of any real human complexity and passions. And we identify with the characters from our world, this brother and sister pair, who enter and change it. In this case, it's the whole town, if you like, who individuate and become more fully themselves and more fully and complexly human. And in this, we notice links being made between gender difference and individuation. There is a tension between, as I've said, the boy and the girl from who enter Pleasantville from our side. The boy wants to avoid interference in this TV world, so that the characters and scenes he knows well do not get challenged or corrupted or change. But his sassy sister cares little for this, and she follows her less inhibited desire by just seducing Pleasantville's clean-cut, sex-innocent high school lad. There's something significant in the way that the feminine is used as the agent of change, and how this corresponds with Jung's view that the anima is the link between the conscious and the unconscious mind, just as in the integration of the unconscious in the process of individuation. And it's also true, as you saw, of the Truman Show, where we saw how Truman's affection for a girl character in the TV show, and I'll show a longer clip from tomorrow, that he takes for the real world, that initiates his personal discovery of his true self. So let's have a clip from Pleasant. It's the first time you see colour appearing in the film when he's done whatever he's done with the girl. I love the attention to detail, don't you? The way her secondary sexual characteristics are enhanced. Pointy bra. So pointy. If you didn't quite get the point, I think the pointy bra doesn't. But you know, is it the feminine that initiates this change towards a fuller self-knowledge, or is it love? After all, if a heterosexual male hero is the standard cinematic character for this type of individuation or grail story, because surely a land with no sex, no art, no rain, no books, and in black and white is as bereft as the wasteland as of the Fisher King to our ass. Anyway, this grail story. What's being said through the way his love of a woman leads to a fuller knowledge of himself as a human being is that love itself represents an other to reason. For a modern audience, it's love that carries the irrational and so provides a link to the unconscious as well. And I find this an acceptable development of Jung's emphasis on the function of the feminine or anima, and one which then allows us to expand our thinking beyond heterosexual gender pairs, as homosexual pairs may also express this vital energy of conjunctio without relying simply on feminine-masculine polarities as the only or the most significant expression of overcoming our incomplete one-sided natures. Passion and love, however they arise, are sufficiently powerful as the complementary challenge to the one-sidedness of our over-rational conscious minds. So I thought I'd just mention that extension. Of course, both these movies involve us in questioning our position as viewers of a fiction. In The Truman Show, we're watching a dramatic story that has at its heart the fact that the whole world it depicts is a manufactured TV soap drama. As cinema viewers, we are, in fact, in the position of Truman himself in the way that we accept the events of the film as the true story. However, we're simultaneously in the position of all the other film characters who know the film world they inhabit is a fiction. I mean, we're watching a fiction on a fiction. By journeying with Truman, we journey also towards a rethinking of what we take for granted and accept as true or real in our own real world, outside the cinema. And this compares with what happens in... Have you seen Truffaut's Day for Night? The opening scene of Day for Night? Well, let me describe it to you. We watch an active street scene, just like we're watching the beginning of a film. This is the opening sequence, busy street scene, everything moving around and busy, but then are stopped in our tracks as the scene halts, and we pull back with the cameras, and we see the street is a film set, and then everything stops, and then we're shown the same scene all over again, exactly the same as we saw it before. This time, though, of course, with the knowledge and the reminder that we're watching a film, something that's been made up for our benefit. And then the film proceeds. So on the way, in these sort of films, we arrive at a new questioning of how we let the big and small screen contribute to our structuring of reality. And in Pleasantville, the disjunction between the black and white TV world and our own colourful world is more obviously stated. We couldn't live in Pleasantville, we scoff. It's far too ideal and trouble-free. And yet there's a temptation that attracts us to such idealistic simplicity. It's our perennial desire for some sort of lost golden age that reoccurs in every era. These days, it appears as a yearning for simpler times, thought preferable to the complexity of modernity and late industrial civilization. Watching Pleasantville, our tendency to be drawn towards impossibly ideal human situations is thrust before us, and once the movie is over, leads us to question not only this aspect of the movie, but also other, less obvious fictions in life we are drawn to. It also helps us to appreciate the imperfection of our own human lives, precisely because complexity, failure, joy, and disappointment are unavoidable facts and not optional elements between which we may pick and choose. Here we are firmly in the arena of the shadow and the importance of integrating shadow contents. In this, we should remind ourselves that these shadow contents aren't simply bad or evil, but as Jung emphasizes, they are the neglected aspects of ourselves, personal and collective human elements we refuse to identify with as not us, that we've not allowed ourselves to integrate. Now, our final film, Dark City, which is a science fiction precursor of the very successful Matrix, strikes the viewer as a world that is all shadow. There isn't one scene in daylight in Dark City. Because this time we're witnessing a world of human beings who are unwittingly living as subjects of experiments by aliens who wish to find out what makes us individual and unique in our humanness. And there's a whole chapter on Dark City in the book Jung and Film, written by Jane Ryan, who's over here in America. This is a theme common to films, sci-fi films, since the 1950s, and, you know, about finding out what it is to be a human being and who are the real human beings and who are the real aliens. And I think it's part of our postmodern need to reflect on our own values in a way that we perhaps haven't done so deeply before, as or with such doubt about ourselves, you know, since events in the Second World War. As audience members, when we watch Dark City, we don't know what's going on at first. But in the first scene, we see a man, Murdoch, who awakes in an unfamiliar environment and realizes he can't remember who he is. And apart from Murdoch, all the other characters, except one who starts discovering, like Oedipus, and then goes mad, all the other characters accept the reality of their lives in Dark City, just like in the other two films. Only Murdoch, our individuation hero, knows he seeks to unravel the mystery of his birth, that is, his true identity, if there is one true identity. This is because part of the story is that the alien experiment involves wiping and replacing the memories of all the human inhabitants every night, and replacing them with fresh memories. And not only that, supplying all the artifacts of life, from buildings to childhood scrapbooks and photos on the sideboard. These that are necessary and familiar to the way in which our ego identities are sustained. The result of Murdoch's quest to find out who he really is resembles the dark side of the Truman Show, where there really is no hope. And yet the hero is driven to the edge in his effort to unravel the nature of his own and all the other inhabitants' existence. And this is what he finds. Right, we're just about come to the end now. All three movies, I think, address the human need to question our existence, our identity, and our location beyond everything that our culture and other familiar context otherwise takes as a given. And such concerns have existed over the ages as a philosophical issue generated by the fact that we possess a reflective consciousness apparently unique on Earth. However, this attitude to investigating who we are was reintroduced for our times by Jung's analytical psychology as a response to what he perceived as a malaise in consciousness expressed as profound discontent with what such a sophisticated consciousness had created in terms of Western civilization. Philosophy or society were no longer sufficient, nothing less than the active engagement of the conscious mind with its unconscious contents would do. It was to be through the psychological attitude that individuals might carve their own path to greater insight. And this is the process of individuation, which involves encountering the unconscious other, so frequently represented by anima and animus, as gendered opposites. As these films suggest, whether we break through to more hopeful or to less optimistic realities is of less concern than the requirement to undertake the journey and the reality of the process of engaging with the unconscious other. That is the task of individuation. Well, I guess the form is now to have a short break, a coffee break. So I'm sort of, how long? When should we come back together? Right, so say at 5 to 9, that'll give us 15 minutes. At 5 to 9, we'll come back and we'll have a bit of a plenary and I'll hear what you've got to say.
ET, our hero, is our back.